10, 9, 8, ignition sequence started, 6, 5, 4. Spacecraft is moving 5 miles a second in Earth orbit and 7 miles a second to and from the moon. So you cover an awful lot of territory in a very short period of time. So we always try to use every second, every minute when things are going right to individually prepare ourselves for what is coming next.
Okay, you said we had a problem here.
This is Houston. Say again, please.
Oh, Houston, we've had a problem.
We are venting something out into space.
Definitely a gas of some sort.
If we were going to save any elements of the spacecraft, time was going by, and the frustration at going 5, 10, 15 minutes into this process and still not being at the bottom of it, still seeing the life's blood escaping.
I want this marked all the way back to Earth with time to spare. We never lost an American in space. We're sure as hell not going to lose one on my watch. Failure is not an option.
It'd be the worst disaster NASA's ever experienced. With all due respect, sir, I believe this is going to be our finest hour.
Odyssey, Houston, do you read me? Odyssey, this is Houston, do you read?
Blackout is one of those times when there's nothing we can do. And seconds become minutes. And minutes become hours. And if you haven't heard, boy, it gets you right in the stomach.
Odyssey, Houston, do you read?
Hello, Houston. This is Odyssey. It's good to see you again.
Failure is not enough.
Good morning. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak today on the men and the women of Mission Control. You know, we have many similarities in our work. We understand the nature of risk. We understand uncertainty and change, but we also know that they provide opportunity. And really, I was faced with the opportunity in Apollo 13 when the crew called down, "Hey, Houston, we got a problem." And my teams were ready because the tools that we use in our work to contain the risks are leadership, trust, values, and teamwork. You know, when we started in 1960, our world was vastly different. There were no computers, no global communications, and the Soviet Union was about 2.5 years ahead of us in space. And then in 1961, a young, brash, and articulate President John F. Kennedy gave us a dream. He said, "We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard." So we formed the Space Task Group. Our leaders came from aircraft flight tests, and they knew risk and uncertainty. In 1 year, we built a tracking network that spanned the globe. And we carved the control center out of the salt marshes at a place called Cape Canaveral. In our next 2 years, we put 6 Americans in space, and we brought every one of them back home. And by the time that we had finished with Project Mercury, we had learned that man could live and could perform in space. So we moved into the Gemini program, and Gemini was designed to develop and test and prove the technologies we needed to go to the moon. There we learned to rendezvous and dock and perform spacewalks. And for the first time, we set American manned spaceflight records. We were now number one in space. So we continued on to Apollo. We were in the consoles Friday afternoon, January 27, 1967, testing the Apollo Command and Service Module. And our crew members were Gus Grissom, Ed White, and Roger Chaffee. We didn't know it that day, but our lives were about to change. We continued the countdown. We had many difficulties, and at 6:31 in that evening, we were startled by screams coming from our crew, and we listened to their screams as they died. And with death came anger, because we knew we were responsible for America's first space disaster. And we wrote two more words onto our vocabulary as mission controllers, tough and competent. Tough meaning we'll never again shirk from our responsibilities because we're forever accountable for what we do or what we fail to do. Competent, we'll never again take anything for granted. We will never stop learning. And we designed the badge, the emblem of the mission control team, and the price for admission to our ranks became discipline, morale, toughness, confidence, commitment, teamwork. Because as a team, we must never fail. Now, in our business, the boss is the flight director. Here's a very simple job description. It is only one sentence long. And it says, the flight director may take any action needed for crew safety and mission success. During the course of a mission, there is no higher authority. And the flight director is supported by a team of between 15 and 21 controllers. People specialize in trajectories and spacecraft systems and facilities. We have a medical doctor. We have an astronaut who provides communications during the course of the mission. And mission controllers are young. They're generally in their early to the mid-20s. And the flight directors are in their early to the mid-30s. And this team on the screen right now, whose average age is 26, is the team that took Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin to the surface of the moon July 20th, 1969. And we literally fought every step of the way to get there. When we finally shut the engine down on the lunar surface that day, we had less than 17 seconds of fuel remaining. And we were in the process of counting down to a very difficult and risky land abort decision. But when we shut that engine down and when the crew walked on the surface and when they lifted off and we got those guys back home, we had fulfilled the pledge that we had made to our now-dead President John F. Kennedy and the crew of Apollo 1. We launched this time in November, Apollo 12, and as we left the launch pad, we hit twice by lightning. And we had 2 minutes to solve the problems, and we did. We got that crew safely into space, and then we got them to the moon. So by the time we got to Apollo 13, this was our third lunar landing mission. The previous two missions had been pretty sporty. We were hoping for a change, something in this mission would go smoothly for us. Our crew members were Jim Lovell, Fran Hayes, and Ken Mattingly. Lovell and Hayes were the experts in the lunar module, and they were scheduled to descend to a very rugged and mountainous landing site on the moon that we called Frau Maro. Ken Mattingly was the command module pilot. He'd remained circling the moon. But 2 days prior to the mission, Mattingly was scrubbed, and he's replaced by Jack Swigert, a member of the backup crew. Now, missions run in thrust. When you turn 7.5 million pounds of thrust loose, that's commitment. No change in your mind and no turning back. And trust allows us to make every second count, rapidly seek out every opportunity. We lost an engine during the second stage of powered flight. Very quickly, we looked at the remaining four engines. They were all go. We computed new engine shutdown times, passed them up to the crew. Everything kept working. We got them up into orbit. 2.5 hours later, I give the crew the go for translunar injection. So now, by the end of the second day, this crew is 200,000 miles from Earth, 50,000 miles from the surface of the moon. We're entering a phase of the mission we call entering the lunar sphere of influence, and this is where we cross over from the Earth's to the moon's gravity. And decisions during this phase of the mission must be made very rapidly. My team was on the console, we're just finishing our second shift. Everything was looking good on board the spacecraft. During my shift, we had a television broadcast from the crew, and the crew's wives and families had been sitting behind me in the viewing room. When the television link was shut down, the families went home, and the noise level in my main control room was building up because the next team of controllers had reported in for handover. Their flight director was sitting next to me at the console writing down the handover questions. The final thing my team had to do is to put the crew to sleep. We have a 5-page pre-sleep checklist we go through to make sure everything's properly configured on board the spacecraft. And we were down to the final item. And the final entry in this checklist asked for a cryo stir. And this is where we turn the fans on and the heaters on in our liquid oxygen and hydrogen tanks. Swigert acknowledged our request for the stir, and he looked behind him, and coming through the tunnel from the lunar module was Fred Hayes. So I got them through two switches. Now, nothing happened for 16 seconds. And then inside oxygen tank two, a spark jumps between the wires and the heater, and the pressure in that tank rises very rapidly over the next 6 seconds. Then the dome of the tank blew off, and the insulation surrounding the tank caught fire, and fed by the oxygen, it was like a blowtorch racing through the bay of the spacecraft, tearing out the instrumentation and the plumbing and the electrical systems and shocking valves closed to the point where it blew the side of the spacecraft off. And when the side came off the spacecraft, the area surrounding the spacecraft was enveloped in a cloud of debris from the explosion and frozen particles of oxygen. Now, we did not know an explosion had occurred. It's 55 hours, 55 minutes, and 4 seconds from launch. My voice loops come alive. Hey, flight, we've had a computer restart. Another controller says main bus interval. Third one says antenna switch, and then down from the spacecraft we hear a level call. Hey, Houston, we got a problem. Well, the controllers didn't know what to believe because none of their data made sense. The crew thought they had been hit by a meteor. And then we see the spacecraft start to tumble, and Lovell has to take over manual control so he can keep his antennas pointed back to Earth. And for about 60 seconds, my voice loops were literally chaotic. And then the training kicked in. The controller started working the problem. So by 3 minutes now, we're now passing instructions up to the crew and starting the recovery process onboard the spacecraft. But all the problems that remain now fall on a single controller by the name of Cy Leiragat. And Cy has the responsibility for the systems you need to stay alive in space. Power, oxygen, pressure, heat, water. But I can't work with Cy because the spacecraft is now tumbling towards a condition we call gimbal lock. If this occurs, we're going to tumble our gyros. We'll lose our ability to navigate, point the spacecraft, perform maneuvers, find our way back to Earth. So we must avoid gimbal lock at all costs. And you're becoming increasingly desperate. You're working in the blind and you still don't have a clue what's happened. Plus 20 minutes, Jim Lovell's looking outside the hatch window and he says, hey, Houston, I see some kind of a gaseous substance out there. I believe we're venting our oxygen. All of a sudden, the pieces fit together. There had been an explosion on board the spacecraft with an enormous amount of collateral damage. And when we debriefed, my controllers described their feeling at that instant as if they were just toppling off into a void. I was a fighter pilot. Fighter pilots in my day used the term looking into the eyes of a tiger. And this is the stark and the very lonely feeling that you get when the only thought in your mind is survival, and you're trying to find a way out of the box you're in. Well, as a flight director, it's my job to lead, so I call the controllers up and say, okay, I'll flight controllers, settle down. Quit your guessing, and let's start working this problem. Electrical bus A is still good. Don't do anything to screw it up. The lunar module's attached. Now, we're going to use that as our lifeboat. Now, get me some backup people in here and get me more computing and communications resources. Plus 30 minutes. My boss, Chris Kraft, comes in just as we're starting a series of emergency power downs. We're trying to buy some time. And Leiragat comes to me and he says, Flight, I'd like to shut down fuel cells 1 and 3. And I say, Cy, we better think about that a bit. And he says, no, Flight. I think that's the only way we're going to stop these leaks. And I say, Cy, are you ready for your final option? And he says, yeah, Flight, it's time. And we have 3 fuel cells on board the spacecraft that use these cryogenics to produce the energy, heat, and water to go to the moon, operate around the moon, and come back home. But the problem is, once these power plants are shut down, they can never be restarted. And very reluctantly, I agree with Cy that it's time to shut down 2 of the power plants. We've voiced up the level that we want to shut down 2 fuel cells. And the discussion is very short and very intense. And very reluctantly, Lovell shuts down 2 of the fuel cells. And this is probably the lowest point in morale in the entire mission because now we know there's no more going to the moon. We also know it's going to be damn tough, maybe impossible, to get this crew back home. I'm not through with decisions yet because I have to pick the return path. And my decision must be made very rapidly. If I jettison the lunar module and use the big engine, I can be home in 30 hours. But something, some gut feeling, and that's all it is. Just don't use the engine. It won't work. The other option, I'm going to have to go completely around the moon. It's going to take me 5 days, but to the best of my knowledge, I have enough electrical energy for 2 people for 2 days. And with nothing more than this gut feeling, I make the decision to swing this mission around the moon. And I call my controllers up and I say, okay, I'll flight controllers, listen up. Be advised that all mission planning from now on will be around the moon. We will not. I repeat, we will not execute a direct abort. And this comes as a shock to these young kids because they believe this is a wrong decision. But they also know a decision had to be made, and they must execute it. We voice up to the crew that we're going around the moon, and their response is simply, okay. And the mission is truly running in trust. We're now at plus 1 hour, and my team is finally handed over to Glenn Lenny's team, and he is immediately challenged because the final fuel cell is now failing. So he scrambles the crew over to the lunar module to finish the power up, but most importantly, he has to transfer the navigation data from the command module computer, which is going to die, and put it in the lunar module computer. And all the computations for the data transfer are pencil and paper and slide rule, and they must be perfect. I walk down to the data room where my Tiger team is now forming up. As I walk downstairs, I think we're literally going to have to do in minutes and hours what normally takes days and weeks. And we're going to be working outside all known design and test boundaries in the spacecraft. I walk to the blackboard in front of the room, and then I summarize the problems. Our batteries may freeze, water system may freeze, propellants may freeze. Large number of trajectory issues. We've got to figure out how to navigate survival issues, and we've got to figure out how to get the crew back through the Earth's atmosphere. And when I conclude this long list of must-dos, I give the team their mandate. We have never lost an American in space, and we sure as hell aren't going to lose one now. Failure is not an option. Plus 2 hours, we now focus on the three most immediate problems: navigation, power, and the return trip time. John Aaron, a 26-year-old son of an Oklahoma rancher, is drafted to come up with a game plan to get us back home on the 5 lunar module batteries. John signs up to do the job, and he says, "Flight, 2 things we got to do immediately. One, we got to cut a day off the return journey." And I say, "Okay, I'll work on that part of the problem. What's the other one?" He says, "Well, we got to power down the navigation system displays and computer." And I say, "John, that one's not in the cards." He says, "Why, Clark, that's the biggest power user in the spacecraft." And I say, "John, we normally navigate using stars. But with this debris cloud surrounding the spacecraft, we no longer can see stars. All we can see is the sun, the earth, and the moon." So Phil Schaffer, another one of my controllers, gets the job to come up with new techniques, developing new techniques for navigation, using only the sun, the earth, and the moon. And he has to get them done in 18 hours before the spacecraft will swing behind the moon. I take another component of my team to come up with a game plan to cut a day off the return journey. And my basic approach is this: as the spacecraft passes behind the moon, the Earth's gravity is going to pull the spacecraft back towards the moon and back towards the Earth. And at the right point in this trajectory, I'm going to use the engine that I would have used to land on the moon. Only this time I'm going to use it to increase our forward velocity by about 1,000 feet per second. We now have our first press conference, because the media believes that the crew's lost. And at the conclusion of the press conference, they're given the opportunity to come over into mission control. We fabricate a small booth over in the left-hand corner of my room and patch in all of our voice communications. So from now on, we're living in a fishbowl. Everything that we say and we do is being reported live to the entire world. Plus 24 hours after the explosion, we have invented techniques for navigation. We figured out our initial power management plan. We voice the instructions up to the crew for the maneuver we want them to perform. And our mission control gets very silent as maneuver time approaches. Controllers are hunched over their consoles, very tight limits upon all the propulsion parameters. Crew calls out, "Engine start," and it's not steering correctly, it's fishtailing. And I say, "Hey, Pop, what the hell's going on?" He says, "Give it a few more seconds, Blake. Let's just watch it." And the engine settles down, starts thrusting correctly, and burns for the next 5.5 minutes. And then the crew calls off shutdown. And then they start their post-burn report, and we immediately recognize our error. When we computed the trim for the engine to be in at the start of the maneuver, we had assumed 2 crewmen would be in the lunar module, and 1 crewman would be in the command module. Well, that assumption was wrong, because all 3 crewmen had crowded in the lunar module so they could see what was going on. So from now on in mission control, there will be no more assumptions. Well, the maneuver did cut the day off the return journey. It also changed our landing point. We're now going to land in the South Pacific, just to the east of Samoa. So we send the aircraft carrier Iwo Jima to the landing location. We now have the first management flap in Apollo 13. Zeke Slayton is the boss of the astronauts. He comes over to me at the console, pokes me in the shoulder, and he says, "Look, I want you to get my crew to sleep. They're too damn tired. They're going to make a mistake." And about the time I got his input, my boss, Chris Kraft, gets me on the other side, and he said, nope, I want you to get that spacecraft powered down. You're using too much energy. Well, the third guy up there in the picture is Max Leger. He's chief of engineering. He said, nope, don't listen to those two. What you got to do is you got to restore thermal balance to the spacecraft. Well, that was the direction I was already going down because we'd been tracking the temperatures for the previous 24 hours. On the sun side of the spacecraft, the temperature was plus 150. On the dark side of the spacecraft, the temperature was minus 180. So we had a 330-degree temperature difference from one wall of the spacecraft to the opposite one. And everything on the dark side was freezing rock solid. Now, the only source of energy I have is the sun. So what I must do is I must invent a barbecue type maneuver to spin the spacecraft perfectly on its axis so the sun can heat all sides. And this has never been done before. And this is probably one of the best examples of teamwork in real time I've ever seen in mission control. Kneeling down by me at the console, I have the design engineers for the autopilot. Standing around the console, I have my own flight controllers. And for about 45 minutes, we're literally conducting a physics experiment in space. We're trying to figure out which thrusters, sets of thrusters, fired in which direction for how long can be used to cause the spin-up. After about 45 minutes testing, we feel we got all the piece parts. We voice the instructions up to the crew for what we want them to do. They try it, and the first time it doesn't work. We look back over the procedure. We're convinced it's right, so we tell them to try it one more time, and this time it works like a champ. Now we can power the spacecraft all the way down. We bring it down to about 100 watts, which is just enough to operate a small fan and keep our communications up. And we know it's going to get as cold as a meat locker inside that spacecraft. We can also go off and get some rest because we've been up and operating for about 50 hours by this time. While we're resting, engineering comes up with a solution to another problem because our crew is slowly suffocating. We've run out of the cylindrical air scrubbers that we use in the lunar module to clean the carbon dioxide out of the air. We have plenty of square scrubbers, however, over in the command module. So engineering comes up with the idea of fabricating an adapter made out of a cardboard cover from the flight plan. Big baggie we have on board, we use a sock as a filter, a hose, some more cardboard, tie it all together with duct tape. Works in the laboratory, so we voice the instructions up to the crew to build one of these devices. And they put it online. It works immediately, and it starts cleaning the air. At the time that this went online, the crew was about 5 hours from suffocation. About the time this device is coming online, my team comes back in from our rest period, and the return status is not very encouraging. It's getting much colder in the spacecraft than we had expected it to, and our water system's freezing up, so we have crew transferring water in the baggie so they have something to drink and use to rehydrate their food. The Navy tells me a typhoon is developing in the exact landing area I'm bringing the spacecraft back to. But the one that gets my attention is my trajectory controller tells me we're going to miss the Earth. Now, when we come back to Earth, we have to fly down a 2.5-degree wide cone-shaped corridor. If we come in too shallow, we're going to skip off the Earth's atmosphere. If we come in too steep, we're going to burn up in about 60 to 90 seconds. So you really got to thread this return corridor. Now, we have no computer, no display system, no autopilot, but we have figured out a way to maneuver. We tell the crew to rotate the spacecraft so they can see the Earth outside the two triangular windows in the lunar module. And on these windows is a gun sight type telescope we use for lunar navigation. We tell the crew to line the crosshairs on the Earth's terminator, which is the line between daylight and darkness. In this orientation, the engine is going to be properly positioned. And we say, Jim, when the engine starts, you take your hand controller and looking through your telescope, you keep the Earth from going up and down in your window. And Fred Hayes, using your telescope and your hand controller, you steer the spacecraft to keep it going from left to right. And then we tell Jack Schweiger to set 17 seconds on his wristwatch. And that literally is the entire procedure. The crew talks it over amongst themselves briefly. Then we hear them call out, engine start. And they have difficulty controlling using this control technique for the first few seconds, but to catch on quick. They call out shutdown. We track them for about 30 minutes, and this maneuver technique's now got us right back within the proper entry corridor. Now, throughout this entire period of time, we're trying to come up with a plan to get us back home using the spacecraft systems that they got, a particular damaged spacecraft. And what I must invent is a technique to move into an orientation so I can explosively separate all three pieces in different trajectories as I come back through the Earth's atmosphere. But before I do that, I must evacuate from the lunar nozzle, get into my reentry vessel, power it up, and then blow the pieces apart. So this is the challenge I've got. It's going to turn into a procedural sequence that's about 500 steps long. I walk over to the simulators to find out how the crew's doing, and the astronaut who's scrubbed from the mission says, "Flight, I think the procedure's ready to go. But one thing I'd like to do is to have a crew who's never worked with them go through them a final time." And I agree, that's a good final cross-check. We're now down to landing minus 18 hours. We start voicing up the instructions to Jack Swigert for the work that he must do on board the command module. We work with Jack for about 2 hours. He reads back the procedures to us. We're convinced he understands his part of the job. We now start voicing up the instructions to Fred Hayes in the lunar module. And it's like we're working with a zombie. Hayes has uncontrollable shivers. Both crewmen are trying to get some body heat into him. His body temperature is about 105 degrees, severely dehydrated, bad urinary infection. But Fred is the one that must execute these procedures. We finally get Fred squared away, get a few hours rest, and then come back into mission control at landing minus 8 hours. And as flight director, I always have my team go through what I call psych-up to get mentally focused upon the job that we must do. And then when we're ready, come on into mission control. They give me a green light indicator from the console. When I have an all-green board, I send my flight surgeon around to interview the controllers to see if they're going to need a stimulant to keep them going. Most of the controllers say, "No, I don't need one. I'm going to make it in black coffee and cigarettes." Well, I put on this vest, which has been my team's trademark since the very early days in space. I pull my controllers for the start of the shift status, and these kids are ready to go. I'm so damn proud of them. That's incredible. But then I get concerned. Now, it's the adrenaline pumping away. I don't even have that luxury because one of my controllers says, "Flight, I hate to tell you this. We must perform an emergency maneuver. We're going to miss the Earth." Now we power up the lunar module, and we use some of our very precious electrical power. We voice the instructions up for the maneuver we want them to perform. They load it incorrectly. And it's obvious this crew is just hanging on. And their guardian angel at this time is Joe Kerwin. He's my communicator. He's a medical doctor. He's one of the one on the right in the white shirt. And he'll be the first doctor in space in the Skylab 2 mission. And his bedside manner with his crew is absolutely spectacular. Now time to jettison my damaged service module. And the crew calls off service module jettison. And as they start reporting. "Okay, I've got her. The whole side of the spacecraft missing all the way to the high gain antenna. The whole side is missing to the base of the engine." And then Hayes says, "Yeah, looks like you got the engine too. There's nothing out there but a dark brown streak by the injector." And as I'm listening to these reports in mission control, I think back to my decision almost 4 days earlier based on nothing more than a gut feeling. And I think every controller has experienced it sometime during their career. There's some point in the mission where you've done the best that you can for your crew. And there's some time when we must hand over to a higher authority to bring the mission to conclusion. We now move into the command module and keep powering up. We initialize the computer. And then it's time to jettison the lunar module. And as we jettison the spacecraft, which has been our lifeboat, we speak to it. We say, "Farewell, Aquarius. We thank you. You were one hell of a good ship." And then I start pulling my controllers for the final time before giving the crew their reentry go-no-go. And just as I start my pulling, controller comes to me and says, "Flight, we got to get the crew quick. Battery C's failing. We don't want to make a mistake now." So we provide the crew the instructions to switch out the battery C, which is going to fail, and move all of our equipment over to batteries A and B. And it's real tough at this time in the mission to talk because we know the entire world is listening to our communications between the crew and ground. And finally, the rookie on board the spacecraft calls down. He says, "You know, all of us up here want to thank you guys down there for the great job you did." And then we get an attaboy from both Lovell and Hayes. And before we can even respond, there's a burst of static. And my team comes to me and he says, "Flight, we've had loss of signal. We're in blackout." A blackout is the time period where the fire event prevents communications to the crew, and it's a really tough time for every controller because there's only one thought in everybody's mind. Did I give the crew everything I needed to, and was my data right? Because from now on, there are no more givebacks. And blackout affects everybody. And every eye is on the clock in the wall counting down to zero. And when it hits zero, blackout should be over. So I call, "Okay, Joe, give a call." And Kerwin calls, "Odyssey, Houston, standing by." and there's no response from the crew. All we hear is static. And we call again, and we call again, and we call again. It's now 1 minute since we should have heard from the crew, and every controller is now unconsciously standing, staring at those clocks, wondering what in the hell went wrong. But in our business, we will never surrender a crew, so we keep calling, we keep working, and at 1 minute and 27 seconds, we get a response. Downrange aircraft calls out, Araya 4 has acquisition signal. Then the aircraft carrier reports a sonic boom. Then they report radar contact. And then we see this beautiful picture in mission control of the spacecraft under these three red and white parachutes. And the emotional release at that instant is so intense that literally everybody's crying. And we're frankly embarrassed by our loss of composure. We watch the spacecraft hit the water. It remains upright. Shortly thereafter, the crew is brought on board the deck of the carrier. And our job in mission control is not done until we hand over responsibility for this crew to the aircraft carrier task force commander. And when it is complete, and only when it's complete, do we celebrate. By now, I have pre-positioned 700 of the finest cigars I can find throughout the entire United States. They stretch from the West Coast all the way to the East Coast in factories, laboratories, and offices. And on national TV, I give the command to light these cigars. Second phase in our celebration is to back out of what we call battle short, because during all critical mission phases, we lock all control room doors so nobody can move between rooms. Then the real heroes of this mission pour into my main control room. And the final phase in celebration is to pass out an American flag to every controller. We started this tradition when we first set an American manned spaceflight record, and we continue this tradition today. Every time a shuttle lands down at the Cape, we will get an American flag, and on the staff of that flag, you're going to write your name, you're going to write the mission, the landing time, and the job that you are doing. It's our most treasured possession. Well, our nation abandoned the moon in December 1972, and Gene Cernan was the last human ever to walk on its surface. And for us, this was a marvelous time to live, because we believed in this dream that we were given by John F. Kennedy, and we considered ourselves privileged and proud to be part of the brotherhood that formed in the early years of spaceflight. And we thank our country every day that they gave us a chance to be part of this magnificent adventure. So this is the story of Mission Control. It's really a story of a team that had a single goal, and a team that was unified through leadership, trust, and values. The same tools that I have in my work are the ones that you have. These are the tools that you'll use to address risk, challenge, but also to seek out the opportunities as they exist and when they exist. In your work, as in mine, failure is not an option. Thank you.